700 pages, how to be a good husband, good wife, a good parent. And those 700 pages were read devotedly by most young Puritan couples as they got married. Now, I need to tell you that that 700-page volume has been reprinted in modern typeface, but it's kind of antiquated in the wording. So here it is if you want the whole thing right away. But Scott Brown and I, with the help of my valuable teacher's assistant, Paul Smalley, have been editing this, and we just came out with Volume 1, not changing any thought, but just modernizing the vocabulary. So this is very easy to read. Volume 1 is out. Volume 2 we're working on right now. Should be out in about 4 months. And Volume 3 next summer, the Lord willing. So this one, we've retitled it, called Building a Godly Home. Volume 1 is a holy vision for family life. This just walks through Ephesians 5:20 through Ephesians 6, verse 4, which you just heard read. Then Volume 2, coming out in about 4 months, focuses strictly on duties, mutual duties between husband and wife, duties of husband, duties of wife. And then the third volume, next summer, deals with the duties of parents toward their children. Now, what I want to do in this talk is simply three things. I'm just going to spend 5 minutes talking to you about William Goodge himself, so that you're convinced he's a worthy example and he knows whereof he wrote. Then I want to talk with you about Goodge's view of a beautiful and glorious happy marriage, the beauty and glory of a happy marriage, and then secondly, the beauty and glory of biblical child rearing. Now, of this book, interestingly, the classic in church history in terms of dictionaries is the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. It's very formal. And Brett Usher writes the article on William Goodge, and he says this, talking about this book. Goodge is recognized as one of the subtlest of early modern writers to articulate the concept of, quote, companionable marriage, his own being regarded as exemplary, and of considerate rather than prescriptive parenthood. His psychological insights into the nature of childhood and adolescence can be breathtaking in their modernity. He even touches on the question of child abuse, a subject effectively taboo until the 1970s. This is an astounding book, and it gives us insights today that we need to hear. Goodge's valuable work unveils a skilled expositor who draws practical applications from the epistles in instructing families how to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord Jesus Christ. And so, in this talk, I'm really summarizing. This is a church historical talk, by the way. I should have said that at the beginning, because every conference we have one that's more historical than exegetical, and I've been appointed to be that one, so this will be more historical. But you need to understand that Goodge himself had 13 children, 7 sons, 6 daughters, and his wife died in childbirth with a 13th child. And he never got remarried. So this is a man of huge amounts of experience. But even more importantly, Goodge was a godly example of the matters he writes about. His personal life was exemplary. Throughout his life, he maintained this habit from the time he was a teenager that every morning he'd read 5 chapters in the Bible. At lunchtime, he'd read another 5. And the evening before he went to bed, he read number 11 through 15 chapter of the Bible for the day. His biographer writes that his confessions of sin were accompanied with much brokenness of heart, self-abhorrency, and justifying of God. In prayer, his biographer goes on to say he was pertinent, judicious, spiritual, seasonable, accompanied with faith and fervor, like a true son of Jacob wrestling with tears and supplications. And a contemporary of Goodge writes of him, he studied much to magnify Christ and to debase himself. This is a godly man. Goodge said of himself, When I look upon myself, I see nothing but emptiness and weakness. But when I look upon Christ, I see nothing but fullness and sufficiency. His family saw him as a loving husband and a dear father, a devout leader of family worship, a hard worker, a cheerful philanthropist, a meek friend, a great peacemaker, and an earnest wrestler with God. His disposition was so meek that his biographer writes this: no one, not even his wife or children or servant with whom he lived and worked all those years, ever observed at any time an angry countenance, nor heard one angry word proceed from him toward any of them. Well, Goose suffered from asthma and kidney stones, particularly near the end of his life. But his faith held firm to the very end. He said on his deathbed, "I'm a great sinner who comforts myself in a great Savior." And on that deathbed, he often repeated Job's words, "Shall we receive good from the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil?" And when a friend tried to comfort him by pointing to the grace he had received or the works he had done, his response was, "I dare not think of any such things for comfort. Jesus Christ and what he has done and what he has endured is the only ground of my sure comfort." And then he makes this incomprehensible statement, beautiful statement. As he approached death, he said this: "Death, next to Jesus Christ, you are my best friend. For when I die, I'm sure to be with Jesus Christ, and he is all my rejoicing." Now, Goose died 1653, aged 78. So let's turn then to my two thoughts. First, Goose on the beauty and the glory of a happy marriage. Now, Goose, of course, was a Puritan, and I need to just say one paragraph of introduction about the Puritan view of marriage as a whole, I think, that will set it in context. J.I. Packer said, "The foundation of Puritan teaching on marriage was, of course, the Bible, as it was everything else in Puritanism. They went to Genesis for its institution, to Ephesians for its full meaning, to Leviticus for its hygiene, to Proverbs for its management, to several New Testament books for its ethic, and to Esther, Ruth, and the Song of Solomon for illustrations and exhibitions of the ideal." The Puritans have given us many good definitions of marriage. I'll just read three quick ones to you, and then we'll move into Goodge. Richard Baxter said, "'Tis a mercy to have a faithful friend that loves you entirely, to whom you may open your mind and communicate your affairs, and 'tis a mercy to have so near a friend to be a helper to your soul and to stir you up in all the graces of God." That's how he viewed marriage. John Dodd and Robert Cleaver, who were often co-authors at that time, both Puritans, said, "Thy wife is ordained for man. Like a little Zoar, she's a city of refuge to fly to in all his troubles, and there's no peace comparable unto her but the peace of conscience." And the third one, John Cotton, not quite sure I agree with this one, but you need to hear it anyway. "Women are creatures without which there's no comfortable living for man. It is true of them what is prone to be said of governments, that even bad ones are better than none." And Cotton goes on to say, "Though some call them a necessary evil, I call them a necessary good." Well, I want to focus with you on two things in terms of marriage in Goodge's writing. I'm just taking things from his writings here and summarizing them and trying to crystallize it. We want to look first at God's purposes for marriage and then God's biblical principles for marriage, purposes and principles. Now, the medieval church's view of marriage had largely degenerated into seeing marriage as a necessity for producing children. If you were a serious Christian, say in the 12th century, you wouldn't get married at all, because to be celibate in marriage, or you might get married, but then you'd be celibate in marriage, or better still, to become a monk or nun, just meant you were at a higher spiritual category. But the Puritans agreed with the Reformers that Scripture sanctifies marriage and sanctions three purposes for marriage, all of which aim for the higher good of the glory of God and the furthering of Christ's kingdom on earth. The only difference between the Reformers and the Puritans is that the Puritans spelled this out in great detail. Reformers were so busy with other basic doctrines, they left it to the Puritans to flesh out this practical Christian living. And so Googe presents us with three purposes, in the same order, by the way, as in the Book of Common Prayer, the Anglican Book of Common Prayer. First, the procreation of children. Second, a remedy against sin, so as to avoid fornication. And third, mutual society, help and comfort of each other. Now, interestingly, Googe writes in the first half of the 17th century, 1622 to be exact, by 1640s, 25 years later, when the Westminster Standards were written, the Westminster Standards took number 3 and made it number 1, mutual companionship. Googe wasn't quite there yet, because he was a bit earlier and everybody was doing this threefold order. But all the Puritans from the Westminster Divines onward that I've been able to study have all reversed that order and said the primary purpose of marriage, serving the glory of God, is to be a companion to one another. Second purpose is to have children and bring them up in the fear and nurture of the Lord. And then third purpose is to avoid fornication. Now, here's what Googe says about these three purposes. First, that the world might be increased, and not simply increased, but with a legitimate brood and distinct families, which are the nurseries, get this, of cities and commonwealths, also that the church might be preserved and propagated in the world by a holy seed. And Googe finds all of that rooted in the creation mandate of Genesis 1:28 to multiply and fill the earth, fill the church, fill the city, fill the commonwealth, with God-fearing children raised in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. So Puritans would absolutely, not only Googe, but all of them, detest the idea of a husband and wife sitting down and saying, honey, how many children would you like? I think maybe 2. No. Well, I would prefer 3. I say, what? Opening of the womb is a gift of God. And you, if your wife is healthy, and there's no reason not to have another child. You're not in charge. God's in charge. The average Puritan family had 7 or 8 children. And half of them died before they reached adulthood. Just last week, Wall Street Journal, there was an article on the front page that they'd done a study now about the dangers of having children, because the average child, from the time of infancy to the time the child leaves home, costs the couple $250,000. I scratched my head when I read that article. I thought, if the Puritans saw this article, they'd roll over in their graves, literally. $250,000? That's cheap. Would you sell any of your children for $1 million? I'm gonna sell a child for $100 million. I mean, that's all we have to pay to have a child, to raise them up for the nurture of the admonition of the Lord. $250,000. The Puritans never considered the expense. They never talked about with each other how many children should we have. They were reasonable. They did not get their wives pregnant 2 months after the wife delivered a child. And if the wife had a difficult time with some disease or medical issues, they were careful. But they sat down with each other and said, honey, the church needs another baby. The city of Grand Rapids needs another God-fearing child. The United States of America needs another child. See, we're so isolationist, we smile at that. But they actually lived this way. They were deadly serious about having large families to populate the earth, the nations, with God-fearing people. So it's the primary purpose of marriage, childbearing. Second, that men might avoid fornication, Gooch says, and possess their vessels in holiness and honor. And regarding that process, which is a man's corrupt nature to lust, this purpose actually is not embarrassing, but adds to the honor of marriage, Gooch said. And then he makes this statement. It shows that marriage is a haven to those who are in jeopardy of their salvation through the gusts of temptations to lust that run through their lives. The third purpose, which is really the first, as the Puritan said later, Good said, is that man and wife might be a mutual help to one another as help for bringing forth and bringing up children and for erecting a well-governed family. A help also for well-ordering prosperity, well-bearing adversity, a help in health and sickness to one another. In this respect, it is said, whoso findeth a wife findeth a good thing from the Lord. Now, Gooch goes on to say, and that's classic to all Puritans, that the model here within the covenantal framework is that the husband would act to his wife the way Jesus Christ acts to the church, and the wife would act to her husband the way the church responds to Jesus Christ. And that the great command to husbands is love your wives, and the great command to wives is respect and show submission to your husband, as the church does to Christ. And so, if you turn just a moment to Ephesians 5, what Gooch does is he turns to the man then and he says, since Christ's love for his church is all-encompassing, you cannot love your wife adequately because being a sinner, you will always fall short of Christ's perfect love. But this is your pattern, this is your goal, and this is what you must strive to do. And if you look at verses 25 through 29, you see it spelled out there. And Gooch says, what we must do is we must love our wives absolutely. Verse 25, Christ gave himself for it, his whole self. We must love them purposely. Verse 26, that we might sanctify and cleanse our wives by the washing of the water of the word. That's the purpose of marriage. We must love them realistically. They do have spots or wrinkles. Verse 27, might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle. So don't expect perfection. And we must love them sacrificially. Verses 28 and 29, even as we love our own bodies. If you men get something in your eye, what do we do? We run to a mirror and we take it out. We meet the needs of the tender part of our body right away. So says Gooch, our wives are tender. We need to meet their needs right away. Now, you can examine yourself by these four marks, but they're really rather convicting, aren't they? Do you love your wife purposely? Did you say to your wife before you got married to her even, you know, I really want to marry you that I might sanctify you and cleanse you with the washing of water by the word so that I might be assisting you on your spiritual journey and present you on the great day without spot or wrinkle before the Father and the assembly of the elect of life eternal. Is that what you said to her? I don't think so. Most of us got married far too selfishly. But this is the goal for we men who are husbands. To so assist our wives, above all spiritually, that they might be sanctified and cleansed more through our being their husband than if we were not their husband. But also verse 25, I mean, he gave himself for his bride. There's an old lovely story of a Puritan minister who actually stopped one of his parishioners. He saw him doting on his wife, and he said, I actually think you love your wife too much. The man was like convicted. He went home and he said, I love God above all, but the minister said, I love my wife too much. And he was just beside himself. He said, the only thing I can do is go to the scriptures. And he came across Ephesians 5:25, and he looked at it and he said, Christ gave himself for it. I don't give my entire self for my wife. I don't love my wife enough. And he went back to the pastor and he said, look here, pastor. And of course, those were the days when people didn't adjust the Bible to what they believed, but they actually adjusted themselves to what the Bible says. And the pastor looked at it and he looked at the man. He said, you're right. Go home and love your wife. Love your wife absolutely. Love your wife purposely. Love your wife realistically. Love your wife sacrificially. That is the heart of headship. Not authoritarianism, but a love that comes with this warm authority that loves your wife so much that for the most part, I don't say all women, but for the most part, there will be a response to that loving authority of respect and submission. Now, this headship then, says Googe, is leadership built on love. For though the man be as the head, says Googe, yet is the woman the heart of the marriage, and the man must treat the woman to her heart. In turn, you see, the church, and that is, of course, then the wife, humbly and unconditionally submits to Christ, or in this case, to the husband, so long as the husband doesn't contradict Christ, who is, of course, the supreme authority. In Googe's hierarchical model, as all Puritans and all Reformers, the hierarchy is God's the supreme authority. He gives all authority into the hands of Christ. Christ ministers it through his word and through his spirit. And then the husband takes his authority from the word and exercises it in loving leadership toward his wife. And the wife is to obey her husband so long as he's in line with the authority above him. So that's the goal of marriage. That's the purposes of marriage. Now, what about the principles? The Puritans actually use the word duties, and Googe is no exception here. What are the duties of marriage? And basically, there are three sections in every Puritan book on this. Mutual duties, husband's duties, wife's duties. And Googe is more thorough than anyone else. He is like 60 pages just of husband's duties alone. 60 more pages of wife's duties. So I'm just going to summarize this very briefly for you as well. Mutual duties, I'm going to give you four of them, and then I'll be very, very quick on husband-specific and wife-specific duties. Number one, guard the oneness of your marriage. Guard the oneness of your marriage. The author of marriage is God, and by his ordinance, says Googe, he makes two people into one flesh. He calls this matrimonial unity and says, they two who are thereby made one, constantly to remain one, and ought not to make themselves two again. And then he goes on to this long excursus about how you need to share your life together. In other words, you can be two people who are made one on the day of your wedding, positionally, but you can stay two instead of becoming one in your actual marriage when you become like two ships passing in the night. So Googe says you must share your life together. And even when you must be away from each other because of occupation, he says, or tribals for a time, these separations should be received with sadness. And when you return to each other, you should return not only to the same home, but to each other's bosom and to the same bed. In other words, he's saying, get bonded together again. The first step to helping each other is being with each other, enjoying each other, sharing each other, walking together, talking together, being together, becoming one together. Guard the oneness of your marriage. Number two, enjoy the sexual purity of your marriage. Googe calls this matrimonial chastity. For the Puritans, you see, regarded as chastity, not only single people abstaining from sexual intimacy, but also married people enjoying sexual intimacy with their spouses. Adultery for the Puritans was a horrendous crime against the marital covenant. Googe condemns it roundly. But making love within marriage is absolutely required. The Puritan word for that is particularly due benevolence. You owe it to each other. That was a euphemism for sexual love. Here, listen to Googe. One of the best remedies that can be prescribed to married persons is that husband and wife mutually delight each in other and maintain a pure and fervent love between themselves, yielding that due benevolence to one another, which is warranted and sanctified by God's word and ordained of God for this particular end. This due benevolence, as the apostle calls it, 1 Corinthians 7, verse 3, is one of the most proper and essential acts of marriage and necessary for the main and principal ends of marriage. Now, we sit here today and we have no idea of how revolutionary this teaching is in that day. You see, marriage, and especially sex within marriage, had fallen under a very dark cloud in the early church. And such notables as Tertullian, Ambrose, Jerome, believed that even within marriage, intercourse necessarily involves sin. And this attitude is inevitably, also with Augustine's help, led, unfortunately, to the glorification of virginity and celibacy. And so by the 5th century, Rome was saying clerics cannot marry at all. And the Archbishop of Canterbury, in the 17th century, wrote a book in which he said the husband should never see his wife naked. Sex is forbidden on Sundays for 3 days before taking communion, for 40 days before Easter. You see, they kept discouraging that intimacy. They saw it as sinful, as dirty, even within marriage. So tragically, romance became linked to mistresses and to adultery, not to marriage. The idea of marital romance was foreign for most of the years of church history, until the time of the Reformation. And even when Martin Luther got married, you know, he said, well, there was what he got some nuns out of a nunnery, and then he said, well, they all got married off except one, and she was kind of interested in Luther, and one of his friends said, Luther, why don't you marry her? And he said, yeah, that might make Rome quite angry. I guess I will. But they ended up having a wonderful marriage, just by God's kind providence. In fact, Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, they all had wonderful, outstanding wives. But none of them had developed very much. Even Calvin, he was looking for a wife. He wanted someone who could do this for him and that for him and that. No concept of romantic love within marriage initially. Now it came, but the Puritans are the one to whom we owe the ideal of marriage as romantic companionship. Herbert Richardson, a scholar in this area, says the rise of romantic marriage and its validation by the Puritans represents a major innovation within the Christian tradition. And C.S. Lewis, 20th century writer, said, we largely owe to the Puritans the conversion of courtly love into romantic monogamous love. Isn't it amazing how the Puritans have been caricatured? Most people out there in society think they were prudes, and actually it was just the opposite. They're the ones that have brought to us the warm, loving, romantic Christian home within marriage. In fact, the Puritans said the Roman Catholic view is unbiblical, even satanic. Goode said, husbands and wives must love each other and make love with each other with goodwill and delight, willingly, readily, and cheerfully. Their bodies do not belong to themselves, but to each other. And the couple's sexual life, he said, should be tempered in measure and timing only by a proper concern for each other's piety, weakness, or illness. Number 3, love your spouse and live in harmony. That's commanded not only of husbands in Ephesians 5, but also of wives in Titus 2. Goode says, a loving mutual affection must pass between husband and wife, or else no duty will be well performed. For love is the ground of all the rest. Fail here, you fail in all. Each should cherish the other as a special gift from God's mercy, Goode writes. So you live in harmony, you see. To your spouse, you should be like a haven in a storm-tossed world. If the haven be calm, he writes, and free from storms and tempests, what a refreshing it will be to the mariner that has been tossed in the sea with winds and waves. But then he goes on and he warns us, discord between man and wife in a house is a contention between the master and pilot in a ship. Extremely dangerous to both. So you should see your wife as your companion. Neither friend nor child nor parent ought to be so loved as thy wife. She's termed the wife of his bosom in Deuteronomy 13 to show that she ought to be as his heart in his own bosom, nearer than sister, mother, daughter, friend, or any other whatsoever on earth. And finally, fourthly, build up each other's souls with prayer. Goode has a long section on this. Prayer is a mutual duty which one owes to the other, which Isaac performed for his wife. It counsels couples, married couples, to pray together in private, lifting up requests to God that they be one spirit, just as they're one flesh. He says that your hearts may be knit together as one by a true spiritual matrimonial love, always delighting one in another, ever helpful to one another, ready with all willingness and cheerfulness to perform all those duties which you owe to one another. You should pray for God to sanctify your sexual life, sanctify the giving of children, to save your children, to provide for your family's financial needs, to fill you with all the gifts and spiritual graces you need. And then there's a whole host of other mutual duties. I give them to you here in just one paragraph, summarize them. God says you should help each other to overcome temptations, help each other to grow spiritually. You should be complimenting each other every day, saying good things about each other, appreciating each other, keeping the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. Must never speak harshly to each other, never provoke each other, show kindness to each other, overlook each other's minor faults, cultivate true friendship, take interest in each other, be sympathetic to each other in times of distress and sickness and weakness, promote each other's reputation, never speak ill, not even in a joking manner, of each other in the presence of others, must be confidential of each other's secrets, must care for each other's possessions well, must share the oversight of the household, must work together in serving others in hospitality and in benevolence to the poor. Well, that's a full plate. But it all comes out of Scriptures. The Bible is still the best marital textbook on the market. Then duties of husbands and wives, I just give it very briefly. Husbands in particular, God says, should delight in their wives and esteem them, and seek to please them, even to the point that others would call it doting. Husbands should not allow blemishes in their wives to slacken their affection for them either. Then he makes this remarkable statement. If a man have a wife not very beautiful or proper, but has some deformity in her body, some imperfection in her speech, in her sight, in her gesture, or any part of her, he ought yet to be so affectionate to her and delight in her as if she were the fairest and in every way the most complete woman in the world. Then, too, a husband must provide for his wife in sickness and health. He must particularly assist her when she's pregnant, bestow favors and kindness and gifts on her, must never strike her. At times, a husband may reprove his wife, but only in tender love and always to steer her away from sin. Reproofs, however, should be rare and administered in private with humility, never when his wife is angry. And finally, a husband must accept the functions his wife performs. He must show his acceptance by his gratitude, by not demanding too much from her, by giving her freedom to manage the affairs of the home. And he must do all of this cheerfully and tenderly. Sounds rather contemporary, doesn't it? Now, in terms of the wife, in addition to showing submission and reverence, she should be content with her husband's work, his social standing, his financial status. She shouldn't complain. Her conversations with him should show respect. And she should be willing, this is an interesting one, to move, or his exact words, to dwell where her husband will have her to dwell. In other words, if he has a job relocation and he feels the Lord's leading him there, she should follow. She should go with him. She should manage the affairs of the household effectively, being a help meet for him, assisting him in all kinds of ways, showing wise leadership skills in the home, understanding clearly in what areas she should dialogue with her husband and what areas she should ask for his consent, as well as what areas she has liberty to manage on her own. This should all be talked over, and she should know this and obey it accordingly. She should help her husband establish Christ's kingdom in their home as a little church. She should be thrifty without being miserly, consistently persevering in completing her duties, and handling herself with sobriety, mildness, courtesy, he's got a couple pages on each of these, obeisance, and modesty, as the Bible commands. Well, what about the beauty and glory of raising children? Good said, this is an index of our sanctification. Children are challenging, and they will stretch our sanctification. But that's a good thing, Good said. It's of primary importance that Christians recognize, he writes, that holiness and the beauty of Christian living begins at home and then extends to all areas of life. Children, therefore, are a gift of God, a wonderful gift of God, and a tremendous responsibility at the same time. So two quick things about parenting. First of all, the spirit of parenting, and then the task of parenting. Spirit of parenting. Good summarizes the whole attitude of parenting in two words: authority and affection. You might better say, as he goes on to explain it, authority and love. Parents need, he says, to have this wonderful mixture of having authority in the home and yet having it be a very powerful, loving authority, so that children respond with childlike fear and love. And Gooch compares this to cooking with both sugar and salt. He says both are needed for a tasty meal, lest it become too sweet or too bitter. A child's love is a response to his parents' affections for him. Like the sun shining on a stone, so the hot beams of parents' love shine constantly upon a child in order to warm the child to reflect back that love to the parent. And by fear, of course, Gooch does not mean dread or terror that drives a child away, but a high esteem of childlike fear, which with sincere desire makes the child want to please father and mother, and would disturb the child to offend father and mother. Now, when it comes to child rearing, marriage, yes, the husband is the head of the wife. Not because he's better than her, superior to her, but it's a matter of function, a matter of what God has delegated. When it comes to parenting, father and mother together are equal authorities over the children, and they must operate as a team. The father hath the first place in the family, both in dignity and duty, because he's the head of the household, but that does not turn his wife into a servant in the house. Goose says, the fifth commandment requires the honoring of both father and mother, and children owe equal respect to both parents. Though there's a difference between father and mother relationship to one another, the relationship to their children, he says, they are both as one and have a like authority over them. Now, the Puritans stressed that Christian obedience from the children to the parents must come from the heart. The disposition of the heart, says Gooch, is what must be aimed at. And that must show itself in action. How we need to learn that today. This is the whole theme, actually, of Ted Tripp's modern book, Shepherding a Child's Heart. It's not enough just to get your children lined up in outward obedience. You're shepherding the heart. So parents must honor their children in posture, in gestures, and in facial expressions. To say, yes, father, and roll one's eyes was totally unacceptable. You must never be rude to your father and mother. And for 20 pages, Gooch discusses how children should obey their parents in the Lord. And he says, that text, Ephesians 6, verse 1, puts forth a limitation, a direction, and a motivation. A limitation, a child's obedience is limited by the laws of Christ. I mean, they must do what Christ tells them to do. A direction, they must obey their parents with an eye to Christ in the Lord. And a motivation, they must seek to bear the image of Christ by their obedience to the Lord, just as a child of God seeks to bear the image of Christ by his obedience to God. So, parental authority is the skeleton and the backbone that structures the raising of children. The living flesh and blood, however, of that skeleton of parenting is love. Love. Gooch said, the fountain or source of all that parents should do must be love. Children must know that both father and mother love them, love their soul, love their physical well-being. And he expounds in this context what the Lord said to Abraham. Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest. Then finally, the task of parenting. The task of parenting. And I'm going to give you here what Gooch calls it, the provident care of body and soul. Provident is an antiquated word. I looked it up in my Oxford dictionary. It said, providing care with prudent foresight. So what Gooch is saying, parents must not only meet the immediate needs of their children, but also look ahead and prepare them for their future, both on earth and in eternity, and care for them looking at the whole picture. Not just satisfied with today's obedience, but the whole direction of their children. All right, I want to close this address then by giving you, just almost in bullet form, what I've gleaned, 12 bullet point type things, 12 tasks that Gooch recommends to parents. Number one, of course, you expect, pray for your children. This is the first duty as well as the last duty that parents ought to perform to their children. There's nothing that does the children more good than prayer, Gooch writes. They should therefore pray for their children before they're born. They should pray for their children when they're infants. They should pray for their children all their lives till their dying day. And their goal should be to leave behind for their children a treasury of prayers rather than a treasury of gold and silver. For the treasury of prayers will stand your child in better stead. Which is, of course, what Hezekiah did. And 15 years after Hezekiah died, Manasseh was converted. Number two, walk in godliness for God's blessing on your children. Gooch says that part of God's gracious reward to a righteous people is a blessing upon their children through the parents' own walk. What Dean Hamilton said about kindness and the impact of Ambrose on Augustine. It's also true of parents, even more so, upon their children. His seed shall be mighty upon the earth. The generation of the upright shall be blessed. You see, we can't save our children by our faith, but many blessings, says Gooch, earthly and spiritual, come to the offspring of the righteous. The most powerful book your children will ever read, beside the Bible, is your life, Father, and your life, Mother. Three, care for your child in the womb. Gooch urges the pregnant woman to have a special care for her child as soon as she knows that she's pregnant. The fathers must be, quote, tender over their wives, helpful in all things needful when they are with child. He warns that even that those who intentionally kill the child in the womb are guilty of blood, even of willful murder. For the child is a soul formed in it by God. The husband, for example, Puritans say, were to allow his pregnant wife to ride horseback and his wife miscarries, that man should be thrown in jail because he's been so mean to his wife, he's actually a murderer because he should know better. So, they're very strict on this. Very tender love to a pregnant woman coming from the part of the husband. Four, nurture your children in infancy. Now, here the Puritans are very realistic. Gooch, too. He says, now the particulars of what is to be done to a child that is an infant, the woman knows much better than I can express. He's basically saying, and other Puritans said this, too, well, yes, the man can hold the young infant, but it's kind of awkward for a man. He just doesn't have the touch a woman has. So, you know, the woman takes the primary role when a child is first born. God has also given her natural, miraculous food for the child. And then Gooch goes on and makes an extended argument that mothers should breastfeed their own children rather than give them to another to nurse. Five, have your children baptized. Gooch did not believe that baptism had any inherent power to save sinners, but nearly all the Puritans believed in baptism of infants on covenantal lines, and that then in turn, those infants, of course, had to come to true saving faith. They didn't believe in presumptive regeneration whatsoever. They despised it, actually. But in baptism, Christian parents assume responsibilities on behalf of their children, and God, therefore, claims these children as his own. They belong to him by way of external covenant, must be transferred into internal covenant for regeneration. But parents are stewards of their children on God's behalf. Six, provide your children with necessities for health, food, clothing, medical care. Interestingly, Guge also expounds on recreation. Children need to play. Now, that must be done in moderation. True, the full soul loatheth an honeycomb, he warns. So too much food, too much fancy clothing, too much pampering, too much playtime can weaken both the body and the mind and can trap a child in perpetual immaturity. But children need all these things. 7, give your children a good moral education. Learning sharpens their wits, but a good education is better than a great portion, he writes. And by that he means throughout their whole life. You need to train them in good manners. The outward beauty of a well-ordered life is important. Rudeness, a lack of courtesy and kindness will blunt Christian witness. 8, give your children a good vocational education. Prepare them for a good calling, said Guge, that they can support themselves and even maybe your family and help the poor and serve society and avoid a wasted life. They don't need to make a lot of money, but they need to be trained well and be content in their job so they can glorify God. 9, and most importantly, a long section here, train your children in godliness. Here he leans on Ephesians 6, verse 4. He mandates that the training in true piety is what Paul meant when he said in the admonition of the Lord. Learning, civility, calling, portion, all are nothing without piety, he says. You can be right in so many things, but if you don't train them in godliness, you've missed the major point. Fathers are especially to teach the Bible through family worship with forceful and frequent applications to fix and settle those applications in the mind of their children. They're to be taught with daily catechetical efforts, be taught by daily real life living in the home where they see your godliness, and daily taught by the examples of the God-fearing around them. Parents should never say, this is the minister's job, this is the church job. Deuteronomy 6, verse 7 says, thou, parents, shall teach them diligently unto thy children. And so Guge says, the parent is a king, a priest, and a prophet for his children in his own home. For who knows his own children better than that child's parents? 10, discipline your children with rebuke and the rod. Discipline them with rebuke and the rod. Here the Puritans were very keen on a balance of young children. Guge said, if verbal reproof remains ineffective, the rod must be used as a means appointed by God to help good nurture and education of children. But it is the last remedy a parent can use, a remedy which may do good when nothing else can. It goes on to say that spanking of young children must be measured according to the offense committed. Must be done in a timely manner with love, with compassion, with prayer with the child, and with self-control. A parent should never spank a child when the parent is out of control himself or herself. 11, provide your children with the means to get started in their vocations and families. This is interesting. They say when they become young adults, you should try to save some money yourself as parents so that you can help launch them out into the sea of life with sufficient means to get them going. And 12, help your children make all the major decisions of their lives, including the decision of finding a good spouse. This is big in the Puritan way of thinking, and Guge is typical here as well. Marriage, he says, requires a mutual liking between the young man and the young woman so that the parties may willingly, with mutual consent, join themselves together. But parents should be involved and give their wisdom and give their insights in 5 major areas, asking these questions. Would the proposed spouse, 1, walk with our son or daughter with wisdom and genuine godliness in marriage, in the Lord? 2, would the proposed spouse fit the biblical description of what a marriage partner is to be? Does the proposed spouse have good leadership skills and a loving demeanor? The proposed husband, rather. Does the proposed wife show submission and reverence to her own father? 3, was the proposed spouse mature and properly motivated for entering into marriage? 4, was the proposed spouse fairly equal to their son or daughter in terms of class and financial resources? They also talked about being unequally yoked in this way. And number five, was the proposed spouse somewhat attractive in the eyes of their son or daughter? You see, they really worked on romantic love even more after marriage than before. And there must be some spark, but they didn't have to be a raving beauty or a handsome hunk. Just some spark. And then within marriage, that average-looking woman would become extremely beautiful as she displayed Christ-like qualities. And that average-looking guy would become extremely handsome. Just like a stunningly beautiful woman will become very ugly when she has an ugly personality in marriage, and vice versa. In conclusion, though the Puritans did not worship the family, they recognized the central place of the family in God's plans for God's glory and for the beauty and glory of Christian living. And so Good summarizes his work by saying this: a family is a little church and a little nation. And in it, the children are to be trained as Christians, citizens, officers, and officials of the future. In a demonized culture today, the Puritans help us to see the essential goodness of all that God has created. In a secularized culture of today, the Puritans' words call us to sanctify our marriages and family life by filling them with thanksgiving, the Word of God, and prayer. In a hyper-sexualized culture today, they help us to rebuild the structures of marital sexuality and gender differences so that men and women can flourish in masculinity and femininity. And in anti-authoritarian culture that surrounds us today, they show us how authority enables love and honors God. But essentially, you boil it all down, the Bible is a call to build a godly home through the gospel. Yes, the law is used as well. The law is a guide, a rule of life. But the best of husbands is but a shadow of Jesus Christ. The best, most submissive wife is but a shadow of the great beauty of the true church who humbly trusts and obeys Jesus. And the wisest of parents is a tiny image of the Father in heaven who adopts sinners into his family. And so you see, the biblical family is ultimately about sinners living out of God's grace, trusting in the Savior, seeking the beauty and glory of that Savior for the beauty and glory of Christian living. And so, as Good says so beautifully, sanctification is not a cause, but an effect of Christ's love. And it follows after that love. May the love of Christ penetrate your soul, fill your whole being, and transform all your relationships, including your relationships with everyone in your own home, so that the beauty and glory of Christian living may shine in your marriage and your family to God's great glory.